So scientists are clear that in the not-too-distant future, we humans need to reduce the carbon dioxide emissions from our personal and work activities down to zero. But there's a major disconnect between the urgency expressed by scientists and the urgency most of us feel in our daily lives. There are professionals who know how to convey urgency. It's their job. They're marketers. They're public health experts. They're psychologists. And each of them understands something about messaging. Robert Cialdini is a professor emeritus of psychology and marketing at Arizona State University. And he's done a lot of research on persuasion, often on the environment. And he joins us now. Hi there, Professor.
Hello, Steve.
Now, you've said that when policymakers try to get us to change our behavior, too often they focus on incentives. Incentives aren't always necessary. Please tell me more about that, perhaps using an example from the environment.
Well, for example, we've done some research on messaging to homeowners about why they should reduce energy consumption in their homes. So once a week for a month, we put door hangers on their door. One of the door hangers said, please conserve because it will save you a lot of money at the end of the month in your power bill. Another said, please conserve in order to preserve the environment. That's the standard message we always get. A third said, please conserve in order to be a socially responsible citizen. None of them did very much to decrease usage. But there was a fourth one that relied not on incentives or guilt trips or anything like that to produce the effect. It just gave people some honest information that the majority of their neighbors were attempting to conserve energy on a regular basis, something we knew from a survey we had done. That message produced significant reductions in energy consumption in those homes who had it delivered to them.
So we respond to what our peers are doing, is what you're telling me.
What our peers are doing, and not in this case by virtue of social pressure or keeping up with the Joneses or anything like that. It was simple information about what their neighbors were doing. Their neighbors couldn't observe their energy usage, so it's not a matter of peer pressure. I think it was a matter of peer information, peer evidence about what is going on around them, what is deemed to be appropriate among their contemporaries. Well, that's a shortcut way of deciding what's appropriate for me to do in a situation. I saw an interesting article from Beijing, shows you the cross-cultural reach of this phenomenon. Do you know that if a restaurant owner puts on the menu of the restaurant, these are our most popular items, each immediately becomes 16 to 20% more popular. Notice, the restaurant owner didn't have to increase the quality of the ingredients, didn't have to reduce the price, didn't have to hire a more expensive chef. No, just honestly inform people what the norms are in that establishment, and people followed along accordingly.
Now, help me with a little bit of psychology, social psychology terminology. A norm is what?
A couple of ways of thinking about a norm. One has to do with shared expectations about what others approve or disapprove within the culture. What are the moral rules of our culture? There's
okay.
Another kind of norm, though, that is more aligned with the concept of normal, and that's what I was talking about in this instance. What are other people doing? Not what the majority of other people approve of me doing, but what are they doing themselves?
And so what is a specialized norm that you're running into in this environmental messaging? What do you call that?
Well, there's a specialized norm that we've hit upon, which is the norm of your particular locale, the set of circumstances that you are currently in. What have other people in that particular set of circumstances done? That's an even stronger motive for getting people to follow. I'll give you an example from a study that we did in hotel rooms. Steve, I don't know how much you travel, but I'm sure that
way too much, Professor.
I'm the same way sometimes, and I know that in 70% of the hotels where I stay, somewhere in the room there's a card asking me to reuse my towels and linen. You've seen that card. Almost always, it asks me to do that for the environment in order to preserve and protect the resources of the planet.
Indeed.
Well, we've already shown in our earlier study that that was suboptimal, that message, in getting people to follow energy-conserving activity. So we added another sign, and we randomly put these signs in rooms in three different hotels in the Phoenix, Arizona area where I live. Some of the signs said, please reuse your towels and linen and help us conserve the environment. Another one said, the majority of guests in our hotel do reuse their towels. Will you join them in this effort? Not join us, join them in this effort. That produced a 29% increase in reuse of towels, simply knowing what those around you have done. Now, you ask the question, what's the specialized norm that you've come to? We call it the provincial norm, the norm of the province that you're in right at that moment. So we had yet another sign. This one didn't say the majority of guests who've stayed in our hotel in the past have reused their towels. When asked, it said, the majority of guests who've stayed in this room have reused their towels. And now we got a 36% increase. All right. So it was not the people in room 215. No, no, no. Those are the people across the hall. It was the people in room 214, just like you, that had the biggest impact on choices to reuse their towels.
Interesting. So this explains the pressure that we feel that if the traffic is doing 75 miles an hour, even if the sign says the limit is 65, that we join the crowd.
Exactly. Exactly right. What those around us are doing sends us a shortcut message of what we should be doing in that situation.
So, Professor, what's the lesson here for people who are trying to tell the story of climate change? The United States in particular is an outlier country compared to the rest of the industrialized nations who are taking action on climate change. Even, in fact, China, in its five-year plan, has a rather ambitious set of conditions to reduce their rate of growth of emissions. The United States stands alone in our resistance, really, to do a whole lot about this.
I think it has to do with a fundamental communication error that we are making, and that is to describe the problem of so many people failing to take energy-conserving action, leaving their computers on at night, failing to turn the television off when they leave the room, these kinds of things. We decry the widespread nature of these actions. And we think that by making the problem seems so widespread that everyone will marshal their forces against it. What we forget is that there's a subtext message. When we say, look at all the people who are doing this wrong, the subtext message is, look at all the people who are doing this wrong. And that message of what those around us are doing is a more primitive and more powerful message than those having to do with approval or disapproval. What we have to do is emphasize all the people who are doing this right rather than all the people who are doing this wrong.
Okay. The climate activists come to you to design a campaign, a message, to get America and Americans aboard taking climate action. What's the ad that you put together for this campaign?
We've actually run some ads. We created three public service announcements to be run in Arizona, and we compared them to comparable control communities that didn't get these messages. And those messages produced a 25.1% increase in recycling tonnage in the communities where they were played. Now, I don't know how much you know about public service announcements, but that's unheard of. If you get a 1% to 2% deflection in behavior from a PSA, that's considered a success. So what did we do? We had three components to the message, right? The majority of Arizonans, the people around you, approve of recycling. That's one message. The second was the majority of Arizonans do recycle. Both of those were true, right? And the third was the majority of Arizonans disapprove of the few who don't recycle.
Ooh, that's tough.
And we depicted scenes, Arizona scenes, since it was in Arizona, of individuals all recycling, approving of one another, and then identifying one individual who wasn't recycling and expressing disapproval of that individual. So the key here was not to normalize the incorrect conduct, but to marginalize the incorrect conduct. And that was wildly successful.
So you played pretty rough here. It was like you sort of metaphorically put the person who wasn't recycling up there in the stocks where people could throw tomatoes at him.
You know what? I think that's a source of behavior change in this culture that has worked in the past.
As I understand it, some of your work involves looking at what you call the norm of reciprocation. I guess the notion that we're not supposed to take without giving in return. Now, what significance does that norm of reciprocation have for people's behavior, say, with regard to the environment or climate change?
Great question. The norm for reciprocation, as you say, is deeply felt, and it turns out to be universal. There's no human culture that fails to train its members from childhood in this rule that says you must not take without giving in return. You must not receive without giving back for what you have received. And we actually showed that in another one of our hotel studies with reuse of towels. We compared a sign that said, if you will reuse your towels, we will give a donation to an environmental cause. That produced no increase in reuse of towels compared to a sign that just said, do this for the environment. But we had another sign in this experiment that said, we've already given to an environmental cause in the name of our guests. Would you reuse your towels to help us cover the expense? That produced a 19% increase in towel reuse. Right? So people wanted to give back after they had received something. Well, here's the larger point that I think is available to be made from those data. You know, you've heard a lot of people say, I'm entitled to use this energy. I worked for it. I made my contribution to the society. I can buy a Hummer if I want to, that kind of message. In other words, they're saying, I acted first, and so I'm owed something in return. What I think a legitimate counter message would be is, you didn't go first. Nature went first. The earth went first. You have been given a set of resources so rich, so extensive, so amazing, that it's your turn now, by the rule for reciprocation, it's your turn to give back and to be a steward of those resources. That's a message that I think would be worth trying out to see if we could harness the power of the rule of reciprocation to leverage some success in the environmental arena.
Robert Cialdini is the author of Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion, as well as several other books on the social science of persuasion, and also a professor emeritus of psychology and marketing at Arizona State University. Professor Cialdini, thank you so much for taking this time.
I enjoyed it, Steve.